Geneva Rose is the New York Times bestselling author of several novels, including thrillers like One of Us is Dead, You Shouldn't Have Come Here, and million-copy bestseller The Perfect Marriage, the hilarious contemporary romance It's a Date Again, and her newest release, Home is Where the Bodies Are. Her work has been translated into more than 24 languages and optioned for film and TV. Originally from Wisconsin, she currently lives in Chicago with her husband Drew and her English bulldog Winston. Welcome to the first 50 pages, Geneva.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. So before we dive into talking about your latest book, we wanted to talk a little bit about your path to best-selling author and status as one of the most popular authors at our library within the last few years. From stories you've shared in previous interviews and online articles, finding success in the publishing world wasn't an easy road for you. In one, you even mentioned amassing a career total of over 500 rejections. That couldn't have been easy. What gave you the strength and drive to keep going? Did you have any particular motivators or strategies you used?
Well, first, I'm glad to hear that I'm one of the most, or my titles are one of the most popular at your library, so that's really exciting.
We have the data to back that up, too.
We do.
Like, we looked it up. It's true.
Perfect. So you're not just saying it.
Yeah. It's not just saying that. Yeah.
Thank you. But I guess when I decided to pursue a career as an author, I knew that rejection was inevitable, and I told myself that from the very beginning. So, and I also told myself that I was going to treat every no as a not right now or a noble attempt. And I was just going to keep going. So I wrote through the rejections. I wrote through the waiting. I wrote through when I did get an agent and I was on submissions and it fell apart. And I wrote through trying to get another agent after I parted ways. So from very early on, I just told myself I was just going to keep going no matter how many people told me no. And I think that's the best strategy to have because this is it's a very difficult career to break into. And it's also a difficult career to maintain a career in. So I think if you go in with that mindset, everything else is just a bonus and it's all very sweet.
It's a really good way to look at it. I don't know that I would have had the strength to like continue on and like even if that was my strategy to like keep going and be like, okay, I still believe this. It's still gonna happen.
And we have had the pleasure of interviewing many authors, and it seems like the ones who have had the struggle seem to have, you know, just such a good voice. You know, they really find their voice as a writer. They, you know, the struggle keeps the drive to be better going.
I definitely think so. I think and the career, even when you break in and you get published, you're facing, you know, criticism. You're going to keep facing rejections because you're going to keep submitting books and you're going to keep getting rejected. So I think having that struggle, I think everything happens for a reason. And if it wouldn't have happened that way, then I don't think I'd have the career I have now because it kept me grounded. It kept me driven. It made me work harder. So even though when I was going through it, I absolutely hated it. Now I can look back and be like, you know what? That was exactly the path I needed to take to be where I am now.
So speaking of work harder, right? Social media has completely upended the way we discover, engage with, and discuss books, and even the way authors interact with their readers. Your Instagram and your TikTok are absolutely fabulous and a fun way for your fans to connect with you and your books. It's no surprise that you've gone viral and BookTok adores your work. So how do you think social media has impacted the book world?
I think social media had a really great impact on the book world. It has allowed authors that maybe they don't have the backing of a big five or a huge marketing budget to be able to reach their readers when they don't have the means, because marketing, traditional marketing, costs a lot of money. So the fact that, you know, I had my first book release in 2020 in the middle of COVID when everything was shut down, and this was a book that was never supposed to be in stores. It was with a very small, that's The Perfect Marriage. It was with a very small publisher out of the UK. There was no marketing. So it put it in my hands that I knew I could reach my readers if, you know, I hopped on social media, which I was already on. And without social media, that wouldn't give, I wouldn't have had that ability to make the connection with my readers and new readers. And it's also given me something now, and I think it's given the industry something now where instead of it all depending on a publisher to kind of, you know, relay information from the reader to the author, now there's that one-on-one personal connection. And I've maintained that. And, you know, I have a reader group on Facebook, and it's really nice to dip in there and be able to interact with my readers when I'm not, like, it's not an event and I'm in the middle of drafting a book and maybe I'm having a hard time with it. So being able to talk with my readers and them kind of motivate me and encourage me, and I think that's really great. And I think that's had a positive impact on my career and other authors' careers and the publishing industry as a whole.
We were just having a conversation before you jumped on for the interview. You know, is social media now becoming more of the traditional avenue that authors are taking because it's so impactful? You know, and we see that even in, you know, working in a library, we start to get people coming in and asking for certain authors or certain books. And I think that's probably how it started with your books too. And we're like, okay, why is this author all of a sudden getting all this buzz? And it almost always goes back to Book Talk or Instagram.
It's definitely more of an organic way of doing it. And it feels more real to do it on social media, where it's not, you know, a banner ad or a graphic design or a display in a bookstore. It's, you know, an author sitting in front of a camera and maybe having fun with it or taking the reader behind the scenes or explaining like what their career is like. So I think that's why it's kind of snowballed, and people really, they want to have this connection with their favorite authors. They want to be able to talk to them and, you know, dig further into their head about, you know, the book they just read. And social media, you know, social, it's also made reading very social. Yeah. Where people sharing, people literally go live and they're just reading and people are watching them read. It's a solo activity, but it's become this social thing where they're watching them react to a book they've read, waiting for them to get to a certain scene. So I think that's really cool that it's done that. And I think that's why it's gotten so big, especially with Book Talk and Bookstagram, because it's turned into something more than just a solo activity. And there's a connection there with authors and other readers.
And speaking of your social media, I do have to share that one of my favorite series that you did on TikTok was where you had your husband either watch or rewatch Twilight and then gauged his reactions to it. I can't tell you how many times I started like laughing out loud on my break when I was back in our workroom, and everybody was like, what are you watching? I'm like, so I'm watching it. And they like kind of get it, but until they watched it, they didn't quite understand. And then they were hooked on it and then had to watch it. So your social media has been pretty popular within our employees too.
Any in-person events that he comes to, people will be like, oh my God, that's the Twilight guy.
So if any of our listeners haven't watched it, you should go and tackle that series on our TikTok. It's pretty great.
I think you do make a good point about connection, connection with the story. And, you know, I think there is this perception among older people that young people don't read anymore. You know, like they're just on their devices. But, you know, I think if you really have community, like you said, like sharing of these books and these stories, and there really is a community of readers, you know, that are there, you know, reading is not dead.
No,
I think it's definitely, I mean, a big thing with The Perfect Marriage was it was like this gateway book, which, you know, Colleen Hoover was another one during the pandemic. And when everything was shut down, it was like, people rediscovered that maybe they used to love to read or they never really picked up a book and they got lost in a story. So I get that a lot at my book events where they're like, The Perfect Marriage was the first book I picked up since high school. And now I read, you know, 50 books a year. And I think that's a big thing that helped. And that was social media and people trying to find something, trying to find community, trying to find connection, trying to get lost in something else when, you know, the world was just on fire. And I think that's, they found it to be entertainment and a community and a place to go almost.
Your latest book, Home is Where the Bodies Are, is quite the chilling family thriller about the sometimes literal skeletons in the closet. Can you share a bit more with our listeners about what it's about?
Yeah, so Home is Where the Bodies Are. It's about three estranged siblings that return home after their mother passed in order to settle the estate. and while going through their parents' belongings, they stumble upon a collection of home VHS tapes and decide to revisit those old, happier memories. However, the nostalgia is cut short when one tape back in 1999 shows a scene that none of them have any recollection of. And on screen, their father appears covered in blood, telling their mother they need to get rid of a dead body. And so now the siblings in the present day need to decide whether they're going to dig up the past or they're going to take that secret to the grave just as their parents did.
Yeah, I remember like when I first got to that part, I was like, oh no. Like, oh geez, like what's going to happen? What's going on? And as a fellow Wisconsinite, I just have to ask, why set such a suspenseful story in small town Wisconsin?
Well, the town of Allens Grove, Wisconsin, where the story takes place, is actually my hometown. And I had always wanted to set a story there. And when I came up with the idea for this one, it made sense. Plus, like, you know, Allens Grove is a town of less than 300 people. And growing up there, I don't remember any serious crimes happening. So I think if you put a serious crime in a small town, I think it's even creepier because it's like, you know, everyone in the town and who would do this. And then there was just little things from my childhood I wanted to add in there. Like we had the dead end and there was like this lore between the other kids in town that you don't go past the guardrail at the dead end because you might not come back. And so being able to insert these little things that were a little, I don't know, lore in my childhood while basing it and setting it in Allens Grove and the property that my house was set on, which was 7 acres with a creek running through it. I just thought there was a lot of creepiness and little things I could pull from my childhood and put in there as almost like a homage to my small town.
For sure. You're making me think about my small town. And I'm like, yep, about 200 people. We had the hollow. Yep. It definitely works.
And you talk about all those things that you sort of added into the story. I just finished the book last night, so it's still kind of fresh and bubbly in my mind, and I'm thinking about all of these things. But I really did like the pace and the tone of the book. And I think, like, I just like the vibe of the story. Like, I don't know if that's a good way to say it, but, you know, all these little elements kind of, you know, just come together to tell a really compelling story. I really liked that, the whole vibe.
Yeah, it felt kind of like grounded more than, you know, some of the thrillers that you read or that are out there, like, but with the nostalgia and, you know, small town, I think it, like, grounded it for Jen, which maybe turned her into a little bit of a thriller fan.
Well,
perfect.
I was a fan of this book. I will say that I'm a fan of this book, and I will definitely suggest it to readers. Can't judge a book by its cover, right? But it's no secret that we all do, right? And after reading the book, we had a fun conversation about VHS tapes, Sony Discmans, cassettes, and other media formats that younger generations don't know about or likely never had the pleasure of experiencing growing up. But for older readers like myself, it definitely did bring back a bit of nostalgia. So what inspired you to choose a VHS tape as the catalyst for this trio of estranged siblings to find out such a disturbing yet important element of their family history?
The reason for using the VHS tape was because it's actually how I came up with the idea. It was like around Mother's Day. And I was watching, I was missing my mom. I wanted to hear her voice. I wanted to see her, and she's passed. So the only way I can do that is through these old home videos that she recorded or had made for the family. And so I pulled them out and I started watching them. And there was a clip sandwiched in between, like, you know, actual, like a birthday party. And then my mom used to just pull out the camcorder all the time. It didn't have to be a special event. And there was this little 3-minute clip of her scanning the tree line at night back in the country. And I'm pretty sure she was looking for an owl and she thought she was going to capture it with this camcorder from the 80s, which wasn't going to happen. But in the middle of watching that clip, my husband came upstairs. He had been down in his office working and he sees this and he's like, what are you watching? And I was like, oh, I'm watching like my home family videos. This is my family videos. And he's like, oh. And I was like, but wouldn't it be crazy if my father appeared on screen covered in blood telling my mom I wanted to get rid of the dead body? And he was like, what is wrong with you? Most people watch their family videos and they're just like, oh, and you're like, how can I turn this into a thriller? And I ended up just writing it down in my notes app because I was like, there's a story here. And when I had to write my next thriller, that just kept sticking with me. And I knew I needed to figure it out and write it. And I like to say that was this little clip that should have been recorded over because it was nothing. So I like to think that this was an idea my mom brought to me. And otherwise, without watching those tapes at the time and without that little clip, I would have never thought of it. So that's why I centered it on this VHS tape, because that's where the idea kind of originated from.
And really, as you talk about that, there is nostalgia for me in that, having grown up with family VHS recordings, camcorders, that is how the tapes play. You have one event and then it so abruptly changes over to something else, or something weirdly got recorded over. It just, that is how they played out, I think. And there's just, a fun way to think about that, because what if?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It puts you in that good, what if, state of mind for the story.
And I'm kind of,
I come up with my ideas. What if?
You're right. I'm kind of excited for maybe readers that might be a little bit younger than Jen and I to kind of experience, prior technology, because they're, have grown up with, I just instantly have this cell phone, or I have this laptop, or, I don't need to even have a CD player, because we have so many younger patrons that come into our library now and they're like, what's a CD? Who knows? You might even drive the resurgence of camcorders and Sony Discmans. They might go back into production. Who knows?
I would love that.
So, to be honest, I can't say that I found Beth, Nicole, or Michael to be particularly likable characters or really endearing, but their flawed nature, their tense interactions, and the complexity you give to their backstories really fueled their authenticity for me, and really just kind of showed how broken their family was. What was it like to create such a trio of siblings?
It was really interesting to create this, because obviously I came up with the plot first. So then I had to build this family within this idea that I had for the story. And the way I created these characters was kind of tracing their steps back to this, what happened in the past and how this would affect their family, and also how it might change the paths of their lives going forward. So you're meeting these characters at a time when it's most likely the lowest of the low. One is struggling with addiction. They've all lost their mother. One has major resentment. One is returning home, who doesn't want to be there. And there's this natural resentment and sibling rivalry that happens between them. And I found it so interesting, and I find it interesting in life. I've seen it in, my family, extended family. I've seen it in friends' families, where you have, a set of siblings. They all have the same beginning. They have the same parents. They grew up in the same household, yet their lives can turn out so differently. And because they can turn out so differently, that's why, there's resentment there. There could be sibling rivalry. You would expect you all turn out kind of similar if you have the same beginning, but the outcomes aren't the same. So I really wanted to play with that, and I wanted it to make sense as to why they would each have this very different path and what caused that. And so in the beginning, they're not likable. And I think as things are uncovered through the story, there's an understanding of why they are the way they are. And I think they kind of have they have some sort of redemption arc there.
Yeah, for sure.
Some more than others. And you kind of understand, that makes sense why their life would be like this, given all of this we've just learned and everything that's happened. So it was really interesting to create these characters and make them so flawed, but so realistic too, and how they would interact with one another and how their lives would become as a result of everything that had happened.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I should say my empathy does grow for them. I didn't, they didn't remain fully, unlikable through the whole thing. You create a really great redemption arc for them. And like you said, some more than others, but
some others.
You've crafted a really interesting structure for the book, a dual timeline story told from multiple points of view. And it really does give the story depth and important context for the reader. It makes it compelling. You know, we're compelled to read on to find out more. Can you walk us through your process on how you tackled writing the story in such a way? And were there any particular research or writing methods that you found helpful?
In terms of tackling the story, multiple points of view, I've pretty much done in almost all of my books. And I really enjoy multiple points of view because I love hopping heads and pushing the story forward while hopping heads. So you're getting, you know, you might think you know what's going on based on, you know, one head you're in, and then you switch to another person and you're like, oh, maybe I don't know everything, because everyone has their own point of view and the way they see life and the way that they interpret life or anything around them is based on their own lived experiences and their own biases. And doing that with such flawed characters who had such resentment toward one another was a really nice way to propel the story forward. In terms of like research, obviously I did some research, you know, trying to remind, I grew up in 19, I was, you know, the first, or part of the story takes place in 1999. I was alive then, but I still needed to freshen up on what was actually there then for, in terms of technology or, you know, little nods that would make it more nostalgic, you know, maybe what music they're listening to, what they like to do, what's popular at the time. So there was some little research there. And then, you know, doing the dual timelines, that was probably the most difficult, ensuring I was giving the past, which was told through the mother's point of view, enough space to tell the story from her eyes. And it's not really so much the story, it's how she views her children and how she tries to help her family and all the choices she makes, which ends up leading to what happens in present day. Giving that enough space to get her point of view and feel how she's feeling, while also reflecting that in the present day with the children. So that's probably the most difficult, was figuring out that. But it was a lot of fun to write, and I actually miss these characters. These were some of my favorite characters I've written. So yeah, that was probably the most that's how I kind of tried to format it, was figuring out past versus present and which character should be reacting to which scene based on what they know and what they've lived and how they feel about the other people around them.
And like I said, so yes, last night I'm reading faster. The story is compelling me forward, and I'm trying to get, you know, to figure out what happens. And of course I couldn't figure it out until, you know, the moment when you do. So then I think about how people read books. And I won't shame anyone, it's not a shame thing, but there are people I know who will read the last chapter first because they want to know what happens. I've been told this. Then they read the last chapter first, and then they can relax through the rest of the story. I've never tried that, but I thought, if you're that kind of reader, then this book is for you.
Yeah, I've heard that too, and I'm like, oh my God, that would ruin my experience if I did that.
Me too. But yeah. But I, like, when someone told me that, I was so shocked. It's someone that works at our library. I will not name names, but but their reason behind it made sense, because I'm like, okay, I get that. Like, you can you know what happens, and you can settle in to enjoy the story. I don't know. But I thought the last chapter was fantastic. So it really
mean that I kind of want to shame them a little bit. Yeah. I'm like, why? Why would you? I'm like, it's a thriller. You're supposed to kind of feel on edge.
But it makes sense, so.
But okay.
There are those readers out there.
They can do what they want, I guess. So as our listeners know by now, we can't possibly end the episode without asking a little bit about your reading habits. Having written and found success in different genres, are there any specific ones you gravitate towards as a reader?
I actually gravitate towards thrillers, first of all, and then I gravitate toward like romance or just general fiction. So I write what I read for the most part. So I write in romance and I write in thrillers, and that's what I've always gravitated toward. And that's why I think that's what I've gravitated toward as an author too.
You and me both. I'm not a writer, but I do. Those are probably my top two genres as well.
So I'm one of those odd readers who, if I enjoy a book, I will almost always read the author's acknowledgments. So I just want to say, I'll definitely be checking out whatever comes next. So that's just a hint. Like, read the acknowledgments if you pick up this book. Don't skip the acknowledgments.
But, they're locked, too.
Yeah, and one of the things that struck me is just there are so many people. You know, you are the writer, but you have such a team of people that you work with that help to bring these stories to readers. So, yeah, I want to thank all of them for helping bring your book to us. But I think I speak for both Kelsey and I when I say that we can't wait for our library patrons to check out Home is Where the Bodies Are. And we are so thankful for you taking time out of your schedule to chat with us today.
Thank you for having me. This was great. And I'm excited for it to hit shelves.
Yeah, we are too.
Yeah. It's going to be great.
Then we could finally talk about it with our people. That's hard whenever we read like an arc. I'm like, oh, but now I got to wait to talk about it because it's not out yet. And
by the time it is out, I'm going to forget the ending. I'm not going to discuss it.
I won't forget the ending.
No, I can't forget the ending for this one. So I think we're safe that way. But we really appreciate you joining us this morning.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.